So the interesting thing about using AI in social engineering is the advice that I use to combat that style of attack is the same advice that I give to combat a very basic style of attack. Hi, everybody. My name is Rachel Toback. I'm a hacker and the CEO of Social Proof Security. We're a social engineering prevention company. And I'm also the chair of the board for the nonprofit WISP, Women in Security and Privacy.
Welcome to the Security Masterminds podcast. This podcast brings you the very best in all things cybersecurity, taking an in-depth look at the most pressing issues and trends across the industry. This is episode 25, the ever-changing social engineering landscape and thinking outside the box to improve your cybersecurity awareness program with special guest, Rachel Toback.
And hello there, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Security Masterminds. And this month, real excited about our guest that we have this month because she's our keynote speaker at K4Con here 2024 in Orlando. Real excited that I got to interview her for that. But I'm even more excited on who we get to have the discussion with today. And of course, I'm talking about our evangelist and VP and just all-around awesome person from South Africa, Miss Anna Collard. Welcome, Anna. You're no stranger to the show because you've been on before.
Hello, James. Thanks so much for having me.
So great to have you on the show and join us in this discussion with Rachel.
Oh, I can't wait to hear. I've been a fan and a following Rachel for many years, and I think she's brilliant. So I'm really, really looking forward to this.
The information she's going to share with us is going to be really cool. So if you've listened to the teaser already, you've had the opportunity to hear about Rachel's cybersecurity origin story. So we're going to just dive right in and get in with the first topic. And that was regarding raising awareness for social risks. And how is it that people and organizations are struggling with that? And those different kinds of threats. And this is what she shared with us.
Yeah, I think companies really struggle with social engineering and human hacking threats in general because they don't yet have the security maturity to defend against them in ways that will really be effective. You know, we see a lot of people say, just don't click a link. That advice is not going to be helpful for someone whose job it is to download PDFs as a hiring manager, read them, and then go on interviews and click, say, a Zoom link to go ahead and do that, right? That just doesn't make sense. It's not effective. And so we see a lot of organizations kind of live in the 90s or early 2000s with a lot of their advice, and maybe they're not still using multi-factor authentication, or they make their users change their password every 90 days, and that's just going to make them out of 25 or 24 at the end, depending on which year it is, right? And so a lot of the advice that they're hearing is still outdated, and they don't know exactly what to do to actually stop a human hacker in their tracks. And so that's what I try and provide for them.
Oh, you know what? She's so right. Like, I 100% agree. It's about giving advice without equipping people with the tools and the techniques to follow the advice, right? And that's like, if you talk about behavior economy or change management, that's not enough. Like, people won't change to do anything if we don't equip them with the tools and the mechanisms. And unfortunately, in IT or cybersecurity specifically, as Rachel said, is a lot of the advice is not only dated, but it's also impractical, you know, changing your password every month or every 90 days. That's an outdated policy, and it actually makes it worse because people cannot remember it. And then they write it down on a Word document on their computer and make the whole thing worse, right?
What are the challenges now to try to get people to prioritize social engineering defenses, and then how to protect against that type of technology being used to succumb to the attack?
So the interesting thing about using AI in social engineering is the advice that I use to combat that style of attack is the same advice that I give to combat a very basic style of attack. The advice doesn't change, which is good because that would be even more complex, right? What I recommend to folks is verifying people are who they say they are before taking a requested action. So think about somebody's job who works in finance at a company. What do they have to do every single day to get their job done and not get fired? They've got to process payroll. They've got to change where wire transfers are being sent because someone changed to a new bank, right? They can still do their job, which is making that wire transfer change to a new bank, but we have to verify that the person who made the request to do that change is who they say they are. They really are James Smith before going ahead and making that change. So how can we do that? Well, we've got to use another method of communication. And there are a lot of different methods of communication that could work. You could use something like Slack in the office to say, hey, just going ahead and making sure that you made that request, go ahead and type back and we'll do it. You can use Signal. You can call them back to thwart spoofing. There are a lot of different ways to do it right. So I try not to be prescriptive with it, what exactly you have to use, but any other method of communication is going to catch me as an attacker 9.5 times out of 10. And I get caught all the time. I'll go back and update, you know, the protocols that folks use at organizations to verify my identity when I'm calling in, whether it's an employee calling in who needs their MFA reset or someone needs their wire transfer info changed. And I will get caught and I'm frustrated, like, why did I set this up to be so obnoxious for my next pen test? But that's the point, right? If I'm going to play both attacker and defender, I need to plan to lose.
I love that concept of, well, I actually call it don't trust and verify, or the zero trust mindset. You know, and Rachel really made the point that it's not about providing complicated technical, you shall do this and that. Like, let's not be prescriptive. Let's rather appeal to like a common sense approach that will touch on all of these threats, whether those are AI generated deepfakes, whether it's like a BC scam trying you to pay somebody, that hasn't changed their banking details. It's all about creating that pause before you react to a request. That's exactly what Rachel said, is like having a verification step. And that's exactly what I strongly believe in as well, is, you know, before we react, particularly if it's something that's emotionally triggering, which often these social engineering attacks or attempts will do, is they'll try and get us to react non-rationally by triggering an emotional response. The number one defense against that is to calm down our emotions, right? Like taking a breather, looking at this critically, slowing down, verifying through some other sort of mechanism, whether that's Slack or WhatsApp or whatever. So exactly. And that actually will help us not just in the organizational security point of view, but it will also help us in realities that we are all faced with this year, both you in the US, both we are in South Africa and India and the UK with the elections and all the misinformation that's going on with the deepfakes that will be very difficult to detect with technology. However, with a zero trust mindset, with a let me verify before I act on it, that's the mindset we have to cultivate and we'll teach everyone, right?
When it comes to trying to verify with people that you don't know, is it's still the same concept of verify, but how do you verify with the person if it's somebody you don't know? Is it a reply back on email? If there's a phone number, you call them up? What about advice for people that they don't know or they can't readily communicate with?
Totally. Really common example. Let's say you get a text, email, or phone call from your bank. We're going to put bank in quotes there. And they say, hey, we're with loss prevention and there's been a $590 charge from Wisconsin on your account. Did you make this payment? And of course, you're going to say, no, oh my gosh, I didn't. I guess my information's been stolen. And they say, okay, we're just going to go ahead and verify with you. Can you go ahead and read out the code that you just received? And you say it's 2599. And they say, okay, great. We have put a freeze on your account. Well, what just happened there, right? They're pretending to be your bank. That's not actually your bank calling you. They're trying to siphon out your multi-factor authentication code that you might have received via text message. And it sounds so plausible, because banks actually use similar methods to verify you are who you say you are when they call with loss prevention. Unfortunately, with a lot of these techniques we use to contact customers, they set people up to fail. And attackers use the exact same method to trick people. So what do? We don't know this Angela from bank number one, right? So what do? We have to call the number on the back of our card. If we don't have the right contact information for Angela, that's okay. We'll call back bank number one and say, hey, I just got a call from someone. They had your phone number listed on my caller ID, but I know spoofing's possible. They had this information about my account, but I know data breaches are possible. And I just wanted to verify this was authentic before going forward with any requests for personal data. And they might say, we didn't call you. That was a scammer. Good job. You caught them. And then we clap and we celebrate. But you know, the most common thing is the first thing. People fall for it. They give away, you know, access to their account, their money, their data, and and bad things happen. So that's what I try and do. I help people understand, what does it look, feel, and sound like? And what do I do about it? Actionably, what do I do about it?
And I think you have the term, and I've kind of stolen a little bit off of it, but your term that you like to use is be politely paranoid.
Yes, yes. Be politely paranoid. You are welcome. Anyone's welcome to steal that. I love that phrase.
I'm one of those people that need this mindfulness or zero trust mindset the most, because I'm actually a very neurotic person. So I'm one of those people that, you know, I do get caught up by my own emotions, or I'm frazzled brained and multitasking, and then I make mistakes like we all do, right? But I have been diagnosed with ADHD, so I have a good excuse that I'm all over the show. We have to use or follow that advice so much more so, because that's my weakness, right? And the patch for that is exactly what Rachel said, is to, again, like, be aware, slow down, use common sense, like, don't react when you get asked for it, even if it's legitimate, right? Like, it's okay to tell the other person, you know, look, I'm not quite sure. Let me just verify. And one thing that I must say also, you know, just, I've been following Rachel for many years, and I think she's done such a phenomenal job to educate, even in mass media, to educate the public about deepfakes before deepfakes were even a thing. Because I remember her doing, I think it was with a journalist, where she showed him how easy it was to, I think, steal his flight ticket. Also, there was something, I can't remember the details, but she used like a spoofing application and then changed her voice into a male voice. And, you know, that was so impressive for someone who's maybe not in the industry to see on like broadband media. And that's what we need more of, is for people to understand, hey, hang on a second, this is actually technology that everyone can use nowadays. You don't have to be a super hacker to create a deepfake. And it can be abused for exactly those purposes, you know, trying to steal your banking login details, get into your bank accounts, etc. So I think the work that Rachel's doing is great to create the necessary awareness.
Are you seeing any emerging trends or growing trends in how people are interacting online? Are you starting to see more people that are being politely paranoid or have that healthy level of skepticism?
Definitely. I think we are in a much better place right now than we were 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And we still have a long way to go. There are a lot of people out there who could still use the support, the education, the training. But when I talk to people now, they say things like, oh, I saw something on the news about that. They might not realize that was me on the news talking about it. And sometimes it's not, right? There's a lot of people who talk about it on the news, which is really cool to see. And I think it's starting to become more of a household concept that, okay, someone might try to trick me over the phone or email. This text message might not be who I think it is. I have found that everyday folks, they don't have an innate understanding of how the hacks go down, but they have this level of, I would say, paranoia that we haven't seen in previous years, where they say things like, you know, 5 out of 10 calls that I get are scam calls. And I think previously people might have been thinking, you know, sometimes I get scam calls, but a lot of times, you know, it is my bank or it is my mortgage company, et cetera. And I think we're seeing people wake up to the fact that scammers are getting creative. They're trying to get around technical tools. Technical tools have improved and stopped them in their tracks from being able to hit your inbox sometimes. So they're going to turn to the phone, to text message, maybe even social media direct message. And I think people are starting to realize that, and they're talking about it in their homes and with their friends and family. I mean, we see the videos that I have on 60 Minutes or CNN hit like 60 million people. Like, the numbers are staggering. I mean, I did not know that many people would tune in for something like that. The fact that many people are watching, sharing, showing their friends and family, it's being talked about. We're still going to slip through the cracks sometimes, but I think people are starting to get it more now, which it makes me feel hopeful.
And yeah, exactly. Hopeful that society will finally come around. And I've always said, I want to work so that I can put myself out of a job.
Me too. I want to work myself out of a job. I don't want to work forever doing this. I want people to get so good that I get caught every time.
I mean, unfortunately, you know, the awareness is sort of the first step. Like, we have to bring people out of that unconscious incompetence and make them aware of it. But that's not where it stops, because even if I know, I may still in the moment behave undesirably. Like, I may make a mistake because I'm under pressure, I'm emotional, I'm distracted. And funny enough, there's been some research about, you know, why do people fall for these scams? And often, the number that flies around is sort of between 40 and 50% of the time, people don't fall for this because they don't know. They have been made aware. They do so because they're distracted in the moment. And that again comes back to, okay, well, how can we help people to be more sort of present, be more mindful, verify before reacting? And that's really what I'm personally very excited about, because that's something that I need. You know, I'm one of those scatterbrains. It helps you not only to be safe online, but it helps you with your whole life, right? Is to slow things down, single task rather than multitask. Yeah, it starts with awareness, but it doesn't stop there.
What kind of tips or advice would you have for folks, either in the work environment or in their personal lives, when it comes to social media?
When it comes to social media, I think people think, oh, it's kind of a throwaway account. I don't log into Instagram that much, or, you know, maybe I do, but it's just not that big of a deal. Like, who's going to come after little old me? I have 585 followers or something like that. What they don't realize is that the attackers aren't just singling them out, trying to find James Smith's Instagram account. They're finding login details in a previous breach and putting those details into every account that they can online programmatically. They don't even know who you are in many cases. Unless you have an elevated threat model, they're not trying to attack you directly. And they're going to take over your Instagram account. They're going to use that Instagram account for crypto scams and frustrate your friends and family and maybe even steal some money from your aunt or your best friend. So it's important to realize that even though it feels like you might not have an elevated threat model, pretty much anyone who uses the internet on a daily basis has a baseline average threat model of just being attacked with a credential stuffing attack, like what we saw with 23andMe. People don't understand the difference between a data breach, you know, a true vulnerability or a data breach, a real hacking attempt where they gain access to the back end of the system, and a credential stuffing attack, where the attackers just found usernames and passwords in a data breach, stuffed them into 23andMe, and logged in as them and enumerated more and more details from there by kind of going through the social graph that 23andMe had built internally. I feel like a lot of folks are like, hey, who's going to come after little old me? And it's kind of like any attacker would. If they find you in a data breach, they will. And it's not specific to just you, so you don't need to be looking over your shoulder, but you do need to be making sure that you use multi-factor authentication on every account. You use long, random, and unique passwords on every account, because it might feel throwaway to you, but think about the people that you talk to, encounter. Think about the ways that that account is linked to other accounts. You might not realize that one account is linked to your Venmo. And whoa, with getting access to this messaging app, they have access to your bank account. That's a huge deal. And folks don't always think that way. And I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine like a few years ago who also said, well, his Gmail account got hacked, but so what? You know, it doesn't bother him. Like, he doesn't even bother to change the password. I'm like, well, and it's exactly what Rachel said. You know, it's not about you. It's not that somebody is singling you out. Think of the network you built around, not just in terms of friends and family and contacts, but the network to other applications, you know, your whatever, even if it's your iTunes account or, God forbid, like your Venmo, your bank account that's linked to that Gmail address. So it is like a key to the kingdom in some way. And people don't think that far. It goes to that, oh, but what should they, privacy, I don't mind. Like, you know, it doesn't really bother me. But you have to, again, that's where this awareness comes in, like explain the impact, which Rachel just did so well, right? That it's not just about you. It's the people you touch.
How are you keeping up to date, or how do you see, in your experience working with all the different organizations, how do you see security awareness managers keeping up to date with all these different threats? I mean, AI has been such the big buzzword in the last year. And then how do they focus on what they need to educate the users on?
I make it a big focus with my clients, and I'm sure you do too, to focus up on the latest attacks that we're actually seeing hitting those folks in the news. I can't just sit here and say, you got to make sure that you avoid text message-based attacks because, you know, we're seeing them out in the wild. If I don't actually know what the statistics are, I have to go out there and get a sense of how frequently are we seeing that. Things like the Verizon DBIR are super helpful for that. There's so many different amazing groups that put out research about this. I think Yubico did something, Bitwarden did something, and put out research about the likelihood of being attacked in different ways and how to stay safe. So coming to them with the data and the research and saying, hey, we're seeing a massive increase in text message-based attacks and phone call-based attacks hitting organizations of your size and in your vertical and space. So what do we need to do about it? We've got to make sure that we hit this and we show them exactly what it looks like in a video. We show them real text from these types of attacks so they know what to look for. What does it sound like? What does it feel like in the moment? And really talk through actual examples from the field. If we don't know what those stats are and we're not talking about what's actually happening from the criminal perspective, it's not relevant for folks and they're going to tune out because it's boring. Who wants to sit there like you're in health class in 10th grade and have people say, don't do this, don't do that. That's not useful, right? We have to sit down and actually say, this is likely to happen to you in the next quarter. If you haven't received a text like this in the last week, you probably will within the next couple of weeks. Here's what to look for and here's what to do about it. Here's how to report it.
Exactly. And that goes back to this whole more empathetic way of thinking, right? That it's not just about me. It is about the organization. If I spot something and I delete it, you know, somebody else might not. So the reporting, which is one of the desired behaviors that we want people to do, right, is to forward suspicious emails or suspicious text messages or whatever that might be, report a phone call so that it doesn't land in my colleague's inbox, so that it can be blocked. And that's, again, that goes back to telling people it's not just about yourself. It is about the big organization. There's people around us that we have impact on.
What have you done through your company or through other means to kind of help get that message across, to help educate the users?
Well, the two things that I focus on are live hacking demonstrations, and we also use new mediums. So the way that we've thought about it is we have to meet people where they're at and keep them interested. And if people are scrolling things like TikTok or Instagram Reels, what are they watching? You know, they're watching interesting content that's pretty short, that's pretty shareable and funny, and it looks like the places that they spend time. And so we try to mimic that back in our training videos where we have two different types of content. We've got the live hacking content that is spoken, you know, not music, and then we've got the music videos. And so we've just kind of thought like, hey, what do people like to watch? What do people like to share? And a lot of times we're seeing dances and music videos and great lyrics and good songs. That's trending like wild on TikTok and Instagram Reels. And we want people to feel like this is stuck in my head. I can't stop thinking about it. You know, and when I saw that email, I kept thinking about this song. And so we've noticed that that has worked. It's met people where they're already at. And, you know, they, instead of putting it on a screen and being like, oh, you know, I'm not really paying attention, they're like, I actually want to show my friend because that was so interesting to me. So that's what we try to do. We try to keep it really fascinating and show actual live hacking demonstrations with a real hacker and also have the content with music videos.
I actually had two thoughts just listening to that because it's so powerful. Like when you listen to Rachel's music videos and that, you know, like how memorable they are, that's all true, but it's also because that's her passion and it shines through, right? Like Rachel is very musically talented, and it's something that comes from her soul. And then she combines that with obviously the cybersecurity side of it. And that's what makes it so engaging. And you do pick that up when somebody does something that's so authentically linked to who they are, it becomes magical. And, you know, when I started Popcorn, I mean, I don't have a musical bone in my body whatsoever, but I loved cartoons and I loved storytelling. And I tried to do the same thing. You know, I combined something that I felt really compelled to do, which was drawing and cartoons and animations, and then with the security messages. And sometimes that is quite risky because you're sharing something from the inside that people might say, oh, that's cheesy, or, you know, but it's not. You're putting yourself out there, and that's the magic, right? And Rachel has done that so well. So Yeah, I love that. And the other thought that I had, which I wanted to share here, is that only this weekend I spent time at the MITRE Academy, which is like a cybersecurity academy that we support in South Africa, which takes underprivileged kids through like a cybersecurity and life skill crash course. And two of the kids have already been placed, so they have jobs already in like a pen testing company, even though they're not, you know, they're only formally graduate at the end of this month. And when I spoke to the hiring manager, I said, well, what made you hire Seth, the one of the students? And he said, well, you know what, Anna, I asked all the applicants, like, what is your favorite port? And some of the university graduates wouldn't be able, they weren't able to answer that. The MITRE student, Seth, said, well, he has a poem that he recites, that he uses to remember the ports. And then that sort of, you know, he said he was so impressed by this answer, that this you know, combination of creativity and art with the technology, that he stood out and he managed to get that job despite being underprivileged, despite only having that 10 month of MITRE Academy training rather than a 3-year degree. And that's wonderful, right? As if we can combine the arts, the stuff that we love, with the things that we know or that we're interested in, it becomes magical.
Is this one of the reasons why you enjoy doing what you enjoy doing? Going back to your theater days of taking on a persona, taking on a character, do you feel like you're doing that with the social engineering?
Yeah, 100%. Like, people will ask me, what do you think the best education is to become a human hacker, social engineer? And I say the very best thing that I ever did was perform improv on the weekends every weekend for years. And I don't know what I would do without being able to be a good improviser. Being a good improviser is everything in social engineering, because you don't know what the target's going to say. They could change up your entire pretext in the moment. Oh, we don't use that tool. Okay, what are you going to say now, right? You've got to completely change your pretext. Oh, no problem. Yeah, we're doing a migration right now. You have to be able to flip on the fly. And it's really important. When I'm coaching folks or helping them prepare for anything at DEF CON, I say, you have to be ready to switch on a dime. You have to practice over and over again with somebody trying to trip you up. Because your target, if they're doing their job and they're trying to protect their company and themselves, they will be trying to trip you up. They'll be trying to ask you about who you are, verify your identity, ensure you are who you say you are. And it's going to be a big challenge. And I think that's the most fun. You know, musical theater, improv, the ability to work well under pressure in the moment is, I think, everything for hacking.
So do you miss the musical theater?
Well, I don't miss it because I get to do it all the time. Yeah, I get to do it all the time. And the music part, while it's not the theater genre, we do all different genres for our music videos. I write all of those songs. So all of those songs are co-written by me and other people who are really smart, like people from Hamilton. So yeah, I know. I'm brushing off my shoulder. You can't see me, but I'm brushing off my shoulder like no big deal. Very casual, Hamilton. But yeah, I mean, I get to write those lyrics and, you know, I have a background in, I used to be in a band in high school. So, you know, writing lyrics and getting that message out there is really super fun for me. And I think I get to do it every day. So I'm super lucky.
Yeah, there it is. It's the magic, right? Like it shines through and it's so wonderful to see. When I speak with youngsters that ask for career advice, I always say, well, try to find a way to combine what you know doing the thing that you love. You know, if you can find that, then work is not work. It's fun.
What would you say has been your biggest lesson that you've learned, either from a mistake, an error, but in the sense of social engineering? Because when I look at it, do we learn from our successes or do we learn from our failures? And so I'm curious, what's been the biggest lesson learned that you've had when it came to social engineering or any of the organizations you've worked with?
Of course. I think we learn from both. We learn from our successes and we learn from our failures. I do think the learning from failure sticks better, because we know from neuroscience and psychology, my background's in neuroscience and behavioral psychology, that's what I have my degrees in. We know that our brains find negative stimuli to be really sticky. So we remember it. And that's why sometimes when you're trying to go to bed at night, you just think of all those stupid things you said that day, right? But you forget the hundreds of funny, interesting, charismatic, normal things that you said that day, right? That's how our brains work. So I think the stickiness from the negative stimuli is an important learning opportunity. Something that I think I've definitely learned over many, many years of hacking is patience. patience for helping people learn, patience for helping folks through the process of a penetration test. Sometimes people want to do a pen test in a way that's not going to be a great match for them internally. They might want to use a pretext that has some negative connotations. They might want to use a pretext that's based in financials, or it might stress out their users. And the process of helping people get to the right point, choosing the right pretext, choosing the right people to target, the right timing, it's really nuanced. And so it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of patience. And I think younger Rachel wanted to get to the fun stuff faster. You know, let's get to the hacking faster. But now I take so much time to really work with folks and make sure that the pretext makes sense. Make sure that the timing works. What's going on? Was there a layoff recently? Well, we definitely don't want to do anything related to job security, finances. We want to make sure that everybody feels really safe. And maybe the timing isn't right for a pen test, right? If we're going to be in the middle of layoffs, that's going to probably hurt and erode trust at the company. So really helping organizations through that, helping people through that, and then educating folks on the right way to talk with their organizations, the right reinforcement to use in the company, that it's not about the slap on the wrist. It's about supporting people in educational moments and congratulating them and catching people doing something right. That takes time. And it's a challenge for many people, especially if their culture isn't quite doing that already.
I couldn't agree more. It's, you know, like phishing simulations, for example, they've gotten such a bad rep in the media because of, let's just call them inappropriate or slightly unempathetic ways of doing things, you know, sending out a bonus phish if you're going through retrenchments. You know, that's very, it's not sensitive. And that can result in like a negative backlash. So we totally have to be mindful of where the audience is at, be aware that we'd rather be seen as like a friend to the people than the slipping the wrist and are we catching you out? Rather explain that this is meant to help you. It's a training exercise. It's not to catch you out. And that can only be done if we don't use unfair methods, right? Yes, the bad guys will, they will totally use the unfair methods. They don't have that empathy, but we can definitely bring the empathy into the game, and we should, because we are all on the same side, right? So couldn't agree more.
Is there a need where we should be focusing more on resilience or focusing more on social engineering in particular?
Again, I'm going to hit you with the both. I know that's probably obnoxious. You'll hear people say a lot of things. And I think there's a lot of nihilism in security where people will say, XYZ doesn't work, flat out, doesn't work. And I want people to be a little bit more nuanced in the way that they speak, because that can really impact people. And then suddenly we're doing no education, no compliance. People are running wild with no protocols and procedures to verify identity, and boom, they're getting hacked. So does every security awareness training land? No, it doesn't. Is it also possible that some security awareness training programs are going to work better for one person and different for a different person? Yeah, that's why we see so many different security awareness players in the space. There are certain types of security awareness training that might fit different types of folks better. That's why KnowBe4 has so much different content. That's why we do both spoken content with live hacking demonstrations and music videos. Because I'll tell you right now, your CFO is probably not going to sit down and watch a music video. Right? And your entry-level folks might not want to sit down and watch spoken content. They might want to watch a music video. So you've got to meet people where they're at. You've got to give them the right type of content. It's got to be short enough. It's got to be bite-sized. And it's got to be interesting to who they are as a person. And so people who say security awareness training doesn't work, I'd say, how are you assessing that? And what type of tools have you assessed? Because you probably haven't tried everything. And I'd be really curious to see, you know, my UX research background. I'm very curious to see how you assessed and figured out that metric. What metrics were you tracking? What was the longitudinal length of that study? What have you compared and contrasted? So yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of nihilism from security, and that's probably not going to stop, because security is really hard, and it's really hard to do well and to do right. And I feel for folks that feel that way, because a lot of times those folks in IT are very stressed out and they're very burnt out. They don't have the budget or the headcount to do what they need to do to protect their company. And so they say things like security awareness training doesn't work. And that's because for them, maybe it hasn't. And I would hope that over time they try different things and they make it actionable so that they can use long, random, unique passwords, use the right multi-factor authentication for their threat model and communicate how to do the right protocols to keep the wrong people out and the right people in. And training and educating folks is just one piece of that puzzle. You've got to do a lot of things right.
It's having that empathy towards your audience and where they're at and what works for some might not work for others. I like the data-driven approach. I like that too about KnowBe4, that'd be very much data-driven. And particularly when I speak to folks who are against phishing simulations, you know, I love to share that latest research that we've published. It was over 6 million phishing tests across our users. And the data shows that if you do more phishing tests, people will click less on phishing tests. I mean, that's a fact, you know. So there is data out there that shows it is effective. And we should be at least considerate, right? And then obviously measure and be empathetic towards who we're dealing with.
All right. So this is the part of the interview that I love to do. That's the rapid fire. And this is based off of the Inside the Actor Studio that James Tipton used to do with actors. And it was always like my favorite part. Now that I know you've got an improv background, it would have been fun to have you think on your feet. You've had a little bit of time. So
okay.
If social engineering is an animal, what would it be?
Social engineering is like a fast childhood dog that runs away from you, and you have to spend a lot of time looking for it in the neighborhood. But you love this dog, and it's really fun to be around. But man, does it know how to jump over the fence. So a fast dog that maybe isn't wearing a collar and is pretty hard to find.
What's your favorite word in cyber or social engineering?
Oh, I love the word hacker. To me, is a positive term. So I use the word hacker to describe a person who protects and looks for the vulnerabilities to protect us. That's what I do.
So what would you say is your least favorite word?
The words that don't make sense to people who aren't within our field, like when people try to make quishing, QR code phishing. You can just say QR code. That's short enough. Please don't try to make quishing happen, to quote Mean Girls.
I laugh because that's what I have in my presentations. But anyway, okay.
Sorry, James. You got to take it out. Just call it QR code phishing.
Yeah, okay. You got a magic wand. If you could fix one thing in cybersecurity, what would it be?
Help vulnerable people become less vulnerable, especially vulnerable folks losing things like their entire life savings to a scam. So please take a beat, pause, ask the right questions, verify people are who they say they are.
Be politely paranoid.
Be politely paranoid.
What would you say is your favorite cybersecurity or social engineering tool?
Would actually just be like OSINT, which would be like a good old-fashioned Google dork. Site, file, type, PDF. I mean, it's so simple, right? Anyone can do it. But the good old-fashioned Google dork will get you where you need to go.
What would you say is your favorite personal or cybersecurity or social engineering book?
My favorite cybersecurity book is called The Social Engineer's Playbook, A Practical Guide to Pretexting by Jeremiah Talamantes. It is awesome. Love it.
What advice would you give to people that want to get into social engineering?
I'd say social engineering is a very hands-on type of job. You have to try things, not just read about them. So I highly, highly recommend to go to DEF CON. And if you don't feel like you have the funds or the support, apply through WISP. We have DEF CON scholarships to send you to DEF CON so that you can try all of these techniques and get hands-on. You've got to try things. You can't just read about them. It's not going to work.
So seeing as we've talked a lot about what your profession is, what other profession would you want to try if you didn't do social engineering?
Well, I've done many different professions already in this life. I was a teacher, community manager. I led a UX research team, now a hacker and CEO. I get to make fun security awareness videos with my production team all the time. And since the music videos have been such a blast to write that music with the superstars that we work with, I would say making music that wouldn't be security awareness music. It would probably be like pop music professionally. I don't need to be the one singing on it. I would leave that to the professionals, but writing those lyrics is so fun. And I love doing that.
So what kind of profession would you not want to do?
Anything with too much power. Like, I would never want to be the president of the United States. I can't imagine thinking that I would be good enough for a role like that. And it really concerns me, anyone who would think that they are good enough for that. I mean, I'm not saying that we need to all be so humble that no one can be the president. But, you know, the kind of the old adage of anyone who wants the power, I'm not sure if they should have it. I don't want to be the president. Would never want to be.
What would you say is the biggest threat or going to be the biggest threat in the next 10 years?
A loss of trust. So AI will give real criminals plausible deniability. They're going to cry things like, it's a deep fake, in response to real footage, real audio, real video, real pictures, text, etc. So I think this loss of trust will impact our elections, will impact how everyday folks communicate with each other. And we're going to need a way to detect AI impersonation. It's going to need to be baked into every tool that we use. And we're going to need really good authentication methods with our loved ones to confirm people are who they say they are. We're only going to see this become easier to affect. I do think it will erode trust. And that's going to be a huge threat, not just in cybersecurity, but for us just as people in society.
You know, in all the interviews we've done with all of our guests, I don't think I've been more concerned, or I would almost go as far as to say frightened about the response to this question, because usually it's, you know, social engineering or vulnerability, or whatever, but a loss of trust. And you think about, as humans, when we have a loss of trust between us and another person, that's emotionally devastating. That's, you know, stressful. It hits all the wrong buttons for us. And with AI, with deepfakes coming on, and if people believe that misinformation, disinformation, and having that loss of trust, that to me is somewhat scary and what we need to do to make sure we can prevent that from really coming to light.
Yeah, and the WEF has just published a report about the top 10 risks that they see for the next 2 years. And apart from the climate threat, disinformation, misinformation is right up there. And unfortunately, you know, that's distrust in anything also feeds this polarization. And then you don't trust authentic messages. You may trust the fabricated stuff. And in fact, there was a study that has shown that people tend to trust synthetically generated faces more than like real faces. So there is this unfortunate psychological vulnerability that we have where we overestimate our abilities to detect this stuff and pick up, you know, fake from real. And then on top of it, we actually do trust the thing that we shouldn't trust more so than the authentic media. And that feeds right into this, right? And unfortunately, in a world that's already so fractured and polarized, it's exactly like Rachel said, that's one of the biggest concerns to societies at large.
Yeah, we need that technology to be able to come along to be able to recognize that. But even then, there'll be people going, oh, well, we need our program. We don't trust that tool. And so, yeah, it could be a vicious cycle.
And for example, watermarking deepfakes or synthetically generated media. Okay, that's all well and good for the good people. The bad people are not going to watermark anything, right? Like, they will create their own tools or use a jailbroken version of a legitimate tool, whatever. It will be very difficult to use technological means to counter this threat.
I couldn't see it any better. All right. So what I'm going to do now is the second part of the rapid fire. And this is really funny. And this really dives into her personality. So part two of rapid fire. Okay.
Favorite musical is Hamilton. Easy.
Oh, how many times have you seen it?
I have seen it twice in person. I have listened to it countless numbers of times. I have almost the entire thing memorized from start to finish. I won't do it for you, but I could recite the entire thing right now.
There you go. All right. If you could ask one person one question and they had to answer truthfully, who and what would you ask?
Oh my gosh, this is so hard. James, this is like super deep.
Hey, you asked.
I know, I'm the one who requests this. Oh my gosh, that's such a hard question. I think it's just the fact that I'd want to sit down with Lady Gaga and I'd want to ask her about all of her inspiration and how she had the bravery to do what she did.
You talked about a lot of jobs that you've had over the years. What's the worst one that you've had?
Well, I won't say worst, but I'll say hardest. The hardest job I've ever had in my entire life was at being a teacher. I was a teacher for 6 or 7 years. Without a doubt, hardest job I've ever had. We should be paying our teachers $200,000 a year. It is so hard, so much work, so challenging, grueling every single day. When I think about my time as a teacher, I just go back and think, like, you were brave. Like, you crushed it. And I any teacher that I meet, I'm like, I just want to give you a hug and tell you how awesome you are.
All right, I got two more. If there was a sandwich named after you, what would be on it?
Oh, gosh. Oh, it's going to sound so like not cool, but it'd be such a simple sandwich. It would literally be mayo, green pesto, tuna salad. Like I'm talking a good tuna salad with like a lot of mayo, red onion, you know, the whole thing, and cheddar cheese and avocado. And that would be it. And then you have to layer chips in it. So it's like extra crunchy. People are always like, oh, don't you want to add lettuce for the crunch? It's like, no, I want to add chips for the crunch.
All right, last one. Okay. And this is a fun one. Again, you don't have to answer this if it's OSINT. But if you had to delete all but three apps from your smartphone, which ones are you keeping?
Oh, okay. This is pretty obvious. Love Twitter. I'm not calling it X. It's still Twitter to me. Email, like my email app is important. And I like FaceTime. I FaceTime with people all the time. I think it's fun.
Being a teacher is the hardest job in the world. And, you know, hats off to all the teachers that are out there. And I get to teach at a college, but not elementary school, not middle school, not high school. Those teachers really have it. They really have the challenge in life, and there's certainly a passion there for them. Kind of like what we have with all of our passions.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know how they do it. I mean, when my kids are just out of, well, the one is just out of kindergarten, and I think the kindergarten teachers have like the toughest jobs. And our primary school, no, I mean, I think they're all tough, and they deserve a lot of respect, much more so than society probably gives them.
So what would be your takeaways from today's episode, Anna?
Oh, there's so many. One of the things I agree with what Rachel said, I mean, I agreed with pretty much everything. I'm fangirling here. But, you know, the fact, like I've been in cybersecurity for 20 plus years. And the first time I got to Las Vegas was last year and got to go to the social engineering village. Thanks to you, James, you know, you took me there. And it was so, so amazing. And I wish I could have seen that before. Or maybe that they replicated in other areas of the world, because it is really fascinating seeing while it works. You know, if you have somebody like Rachel, I mean, she's obviously super talented. And now listening to what she said, her background in drama and theater, that shines through, right? To watch that and learn from these social engineering experts, or even if they're learning to become one and watch those competitions, it's so educational. And I think that anyone that's interested to join this field from a more human sort of thing, you know, should go and watch these SE Village competitions. If there's a way that we can replicate it in to Africa or somewhere else, it would be great. The other thing I took out of this conversation is just Rachel's humbleness. I mean, she's so talented. She brings her gifts to her work, and that shines through, and that's the reason why she's as successful as she is. And she just sounds like such an amazing, nice person. So I'd love to meet her one day in person. And yeah, and it's just another testament to the amazing people we have in cybersecurity. That's why it's such an awesome industry, right? Because a lot of people, particularly sort of leaders in that field, are like that. They're willing to share their knowledge. They're not hung up about the gifts that they may have. They just sort of pragmatically take it and do the best. And yeah, I got that sense out of this. What about you?
Oh, for me, it just getting the opportunity to chat with her and, like you said, seeing how down to earth, how humble, you know, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time, but just her experience and what she's doing and using technology, and then also being on 60 Minutes and getting that exposure, that attention, and now being that recognizable force in the industry. I'm looking, knowing that she's coming to K4Con, I'm looking forward to seeing her this week. I cannot confirm or deny that I may or may not be bringing a little brown bag with me backstage to meet her that would have the sandwich she talked about. The toe back, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, everything about it was yummy, but I'm not an avocado person, so I may have to pull that out. But, you know, chips and a sandwich, oh, I'm all for it. I think it's great.
Oh, it sounds delicious. I love the apple pot too.
Oh, yeah. A little Irish butter and some potato chips. Good to go. Well, Anna, it has been an absolute treat and joy to record this with you here today. Real excited that you got to be a part of it. Even though you've been a guest, I think this was more fun this time around, and glad that you were able to be a part of it. So for everybody that's listening, thank you for your attention here today and listening. And don't forget to check us out. We're on LinkedIn. And I'm James McQuiggan, Security Awareness Advocate here at KnowBefore. And say goodbye, Anna.
Goodbye, Anna.
You've been listening to the Security Masterminds podcast, sponsored by KnowBefore. For more information, please visit knowbefore.com. This podcast is produced by James McQuiggan and Javad Malik, with music by Brian Sanishin. We invite you to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues, and of course, you can subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Come back next month as we bring you another Security Mastermind, sharing their expertise and knowledge with you from the world of cybersecurity.